This is a special presentation of KNKX News. I'm Ed Ronco. 5 years ago, the deadliest single landslide in U.S. history happened in Snohomish County. KNKX spoke to people for stories we originally aired last week on the eve of the anniversary. We wanted to bring you that coverage in one place. And so, for the next hour, that's what we'll hear. Voices of those who responded, a person who survived, an attorney who represented some of the families, and the state's commissioner of public lands. 43 people died in Oso, more were injured, and thousands had their lives changed forever. There are thousands of perspectives on what happened. There were different reactions to talking about it as well. Some people wanted to tell us everything, some wanted to be left alone, and some people were happy to talk, but not on the microphone. And I want to say that because tonight's program is going to offer some perspectives, but it is not comprehensive. There are more stories to tell, and there will always be more stories to tell. Before we begin, we know that this is a really difficult subject for people, including many who are not directly impacted by the slide. Our colleague Kirsten Kendrick had a conversation with a woman named Laura Takas, who specializes in sudden and traumatic loss. She is a clinical director and therapist at Virginia Mason, and while she has not worked directly with any of the Oso survivors, we think what she had to say would be good for a lot of people to hear.
What I hear most often from the survivors that I'm working with is that they still want to talk about their loved one. They do not want them to be forgotten. And when people ask about the life of their loved one or ask the survivor, how are they doing, talking about it can be extraordinarily healing and really decrease feelings of isolation, that they're not the only ones who are remembering and still grieving their loved one.
Is there something you find yourself telling people that you work with who are dealing with grief, any kind of grief?
The residual of this loss, of this death, will stay with you forever, for your lifetime. And that's okay. We can only grieve what we love. It's an expression. Grief is an expression of our love for someone. Oftentimes people will be fearful that this is a sign of weakness and I should be stronger.
That's Laura Takas, who specializes in sudden and traumatic loss, talking with KNKX's Kirsten Kendrick. If you want to hear their entire conversation, it is on our website, knkx.org. This is a hard anniversary. The scale of what happened was huge. So was the scale of interest in it. The story went around the world, and news media quickly arrived here. We are going to hear a couple of conversations about covering the Oso landslide, what it means to show up as an outsider, and later, what it means to be here for the long haul. We begin with Phyllis Fletcher and Gabriel Spitzer, though. 5 years ago, Phyllis was a reporter for KUOW Public Radio in Seattle. Gabriel Spitzer now hosts Sound Effect here on KNKX. But 5 years ago, he was one of the many reporters from our station who also showed up in the Stillaguamish Valley to talk to people about what had only just happened.
We showed up in Arlington, which is where the presser was. This is, you know, quite a ways from Oso, but it's the kind of the nearest hub community. And I rolled into kind of the center of town, not knowing exactly where the press conference was going to be. And I saw someone just walking by, and I unrolled my window, and I asked, you know, where's the sort of the main drag or whatever? And she seemed really kind of dazed and, you know, pointing me in the right direction and everything, and just seemed so out of her body almost. And it occurred to me only then, I think, that, man, you know, these are small towns. Everybody knows everybody. And so they probably all know people who are missing.
Yeah. It was the kind of thing where getting the press conference part was the easy part. And then you have to kind of steel yourself as being this interloper with headphones who not only is alive after this terrible event, but wasn't even there for it. You know, coming in a full day later and being like, excuse me, you know, can you tell me what happened? And what I was struck by was how generous people were
so,
with us.
Absolutely. They're so gracious.
Yeah.
It's true.
One of the people I got to meet a few days after was a big lumberjack-looking type dude named Bob DeYoung. And he was at one of the community meetings. And he was so funny about it because he saw me and the New York Times guy looking at him. And he immediately sized us up and was like, it's the Paul Bunyan thing, isn't it? Because he was like 6'5", and he was probably 300 pounds, and he was in jeans that were muddy, boots caked with mud, the plaid shirt, the thick suspenders, the whole thing. But he was basically like, I get it. Okay, sure, we can do this. And he was the sweetest, most amazing guy, and had been out all day, all night for days trying to rescue and recover his neighbors. And he was like, they can tell us that we can't do this or we can't do that as much as they want. I'm going back out there. And he ended up only being able to do recovery work. But his wife was right there supporting him, cooking meals for hundreds of people every night, working in the kitchen in that community hall there. And what'll always bother me about that is that I think that it took a toll on his health, and he only lived a couple more years.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I got to do an interview again with him 6 months after that, and I heard how hard things had been for them, how hard it was for them emotionally, and I think especially for him, because he had been in law enforcement for a long time, and he's this big, tough lumberjack dude, and, you know, he felt all this responsibility to, like, not crack. It just makes me think about the collective trauma that a town experiences when something major like this hits, and that my goal would be to never add to that.
They're bearing witness. They're the storytellers, and we should be middlemen in some ways.
Yeah, yeah. And if what we do helps, that's great. And I'm really grateful for that if it does.
Just one other thing I'll say is that it was nice that, you know, we worked for competing news organizations, but you and me and the Associated Press, Donna Blankenship, we all worked together, and I saw a lot of that.
I remember being so grateful when I saw you there. I know one person, you know, and at least one or two people here know that I'm not a jerk, even if I do anything today that makes me feel like one.
Thank you for your work, Phyllis.
Oh, thanks, Gabe.
Thanks for not being a jerk.
I know. One of the funnest things I got to do was in the community center, there was a girl who was really, really curious about what I was doing. I was like, want to take over? And I gave her my recording kit. I gave her my mic and my recorder and everything. And she went around interviewing people, man. She did a pretty good job.
Did you use any of her tape?
Yep.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah, we sure did. Yeah.
That's awesome.
Yeah. Yeah, it was great.
Phyllis Fletcher edits podcasts for American Public Media, but was a reporter at public radio station KUOW 5 years ago. Gabriel Spitzer works here at KNKX and was among the reporters we sent to cover the Oso slide. For Gabriel and Phyllis, and most of the other reporters, the landslide story went away after a few weeks. That was not the case for the Daily Herald in Everett. Their reporters covered Oso, Arlington, and Darrington long before the slide, and they are still covering its aftermath. They invited us into their newsroom to offer a view of what it's like to be both the outsider responding to the news and be here for the long haul, getting to know the people affected on a very personal level.
My name is Noah Hagelin. I'm a reporter here at the Daily Herald in Everett.
And I'm Ricky King, and I'm currently the assistant local editor.
This was such a massive event, but you continue to cover those communities, both because of the landslide and because of just you cover those communities. And I wonder if you know, seeing people who were affected by the landslide in other contexts, if that has kind of crossed into your job, when you might go to a government meeting up there or have to do a story out of one of those communities, but yet there's kind of this shadow of this thing happening, or is it in the background still?
Just like the scar on the physical scar on the landscape, this is a permanent feature of the culture. In that whole valley, this will be, you know, part of the history that will be transmitted through generations.
And for me, because people from all over our county and really the state and the world came to help, is that I've run into a lot of those people elsewhere. And then even, you know, last year I went to Darrington to do a feature story on a woman who teaches carnivorous plants. And I stopped by the fire station, and I think it's just because it's this thing that, I mean, everyone went through it in their own way, but we cross paths and we recognize that in each other, and it still comes up. And sometimes for me, when I go to an event and I run into someone, even if I haven't met them before and I can say, I know who you are, and there's that feeling of like, you don't have to explain your whole story to me. I know who you lost.
Let's talk about the day itself. How'd you get the news?
So I woke up and I checked Twitter and I saw that the State Patrol had reported Med over the roadway. And I knew that that area had slid before. And so I came in and I covered the story throughout that first day. And then I remember that night listening to the scanner when I heard them have to call off the search.
When did you get to the scene?
Some of the early days, I covered some of the press conferences in Arlington. And then Wednesday, which was day five, I was one of the first reporters that was actually let into the slide zone. I went up with the sheriff. And I remember standing on the road and seeing these little, like, yellow patches. And it was like, oh, that's the yellow lines of the highway beneath the mud.
When did you first realize this is not just a story we're going to be dealing with this week, but this is something that we will be doing coverage on in some form for years?
I think it was within the first week or two that we knew that, and that was something I learned at the time was someone that I know who's been through major incidents told me, like, we have to have a plan for 6 months from now.
Any kind of tragedy like this, you have sort of an arc of what happens next, and there's always the bravery, and we definitely recognize that. We have the sorrow of losing people, and then there are always the questions, what went wrong? And those started up pretty quick. I mean, in the first week, there were already questions being raised about whether there were warning signs and who was responsible for issuing any warnings, and if the people in the valley, were aware of some of the dangers.
There was a lot of coverage of this from outside. You were obviously quite busy covering this yourself, but did you get a chance to see any of that coverage, and what were your impressions of it?
Some of the other coverage of the incident kind of ranged from, oh, it's this area outside of Seattle, which kind of gave the impression that it was some suburb, and it's definitely not. And then on the other hand, you get the kind of sense that this was some kind of anonymous hamlet, and it definitely is not that either. There's a very, it has Oso and the surrounding area has its own flavor, and any incident like this that draws people from all over the country and internationally, some of the insensitivity can kind of grate on you.
Another thing, too, is I went to one bar and talked to one person, and therefore I understand the whole community and history and narrative. And I think it made me a little bit more aware of my own reporting, of realizing that you have blinders and there's things you don't know what you don't know. And people who are closer to the situation may read some of that as ignorance.
The landslide happens. There's the aftermath. July comes. They wrap up the search for victims. Where does the Herald's coverage go from there? What do you look at as a news organization and say, okay, this isn't over, so what now?
I remember that it was an intense conversation that we had for a long time of when is the first day that the slide isn't on the front page. And I think it was months. And I remember it just felt so strange, and were we making the right decision? But then also for us, those personal stories of loss and recovery and resilience, those really lasted intensely for at least a year. And then these moments that still happen, there's the moment when the highway reopened and what that meant. And there's the moment when the daffodils bloomed again and what that meant. Or one of the times that I was invited out there, there was a baby who was, pretty severely injured in the slide. And I saw him and he was jumping in a puddle. And, that moment is part of the story, too.
What do you want to make sure we know as we go about discussing this thing that you have been covering for so long?
I think, one, from the fact-finding perspective, we never got a full trial. We never got an open airing of everything that all the scientific experts had come up with and the other investigators who looked into the causes and what we know and we don't know, because there was, a substantial settlement. When the slide happened, the extent of it caught a lot of people by surprise, and with good reason, because in human memory, nobody had any frame of reference to understand that the debris flow, this mud, rock, tree, water, slurry could wash across the valley and destroy everything in its path. Now we know that can happen, and the historical evidence shows that it happened quite often in over thousands of years since the glaciers retreated.
Ricky, same question to you. What do you hope we keep in mind as we set out to tell this story?
I think sometimes it's so easy, and I see this in my own life, is that people just shut it down. Like, oh, that was so sad. Like, I don't want to think about that. Or, that was 18 national tragedies ago. But, there were people who lost six of their relatives, but also there's really been some really beautiful human kindness that has come out of that, and people who didn't know each other before that now are lifelong friends because they had to get through this and they had to help each other.
Ricky King, Noah Haglund, thank you both for your time.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
They both work for the Daily Herald in Everett. They were reporting on this area long before the landslide, and they are still regularly covering these communities. Their stories are available at heraldnet.com. You're listening to a special report, Remembering Oso, 5 years later. I'm Ed Ronco. The massive landslide 5 years ago this month killed 43 people, and thousands of lives were changed forever. A couple of weeks ago, we visited the Rhodes River Ranch in Oso. The restaurant here was the site of fundraisers for the victims and survivors, and it remains a community gathering space. It is where we met Jeff McClelland. He's deputy fire chief and senior medical officer at Snohomish County Fire District 24. When the call for help went out, McClelland was home working on his goat farm near Darrington.
We're in the baby season where we're going to birth about 60 babies, and my wife was in the middle of helping two does birth. I looked at her because she's on the fire department too, and I said, it's just a mudslide. I'll take care of it. I go grab the engine, clean up the mud off the highway. I'll be back in 30 minutes. Yeah. That was my idea when the page went out, and so I took off to go down and deal with that. We were busy for, I believe, 18 days straight. We'd go home. The first night we got home probably about midnight. We had some great rescues that first day. We saved some people.
McClelland was among hundreds of responders in the immediate aftermath of the landslide. That included people who never went to the scene but worked to support those who were searching for victims.
That is community. That's my America, and I love that, you know, where people just came out and said, I can't dig, I can't pull stuff out of the way, but I can provide you a meal.
He says the community spirit existed before the landslide, but it is unshakable now. He knows there will be growth here, and that more people, new people, will choose to live in the Stillaguamish Valley.
But I believe that as people come in, they'll learn that there's been a great group of people that have lived here for a long time, and they'll join that spirit of that we are a community and we want to do the best thing to make our community successful, prosperous, and a great place for people to live and for kids to grow up.
Jeff McClelland was one of the first responders who worked for weeks on the Oso landslide. He talked to us at Rhodes River Ranch in Oso. As those weeks turned into months, the community sought answers. How could this have happened? Should we have been warned? Who's to blame? Many of the families turned to the legal system.
One of the things that was most striking to me was just how important the families were to each other, both the families that knew each other and then the families that grew out of the tragedy.
That's Emily Harris. We're sitting in her office at Core Cronin, the Seattle law firm where she's managing partner. This is one of four firms to represent families of the victims who brought a lawsuit against a company that owns timberlands, Snohomish County, and the state. They said man-made changes to the terrain worsened the slide and made it more likely that it would happen, and that the people who lived below were not properly warned. It was her team that also discovered a big problem, missing emails that documented the work of experts the state hired to study the landslide. It turns out those emails were intentionally deleted.
Under an agreement of the parties, the state was to produce the expert files. Those expert files were to include expert communications. The state had seven or eight different experts that were geographically dispersed, but they were producing a single report, which meant that they all had to be communicating and collaborating. So the way that it kind of revealed itself was that we were preparing to take one of the first experts' depositions. We were looking at the files, and there was a file produced, like an Outlook file, and it said communications, and you open it up, and there was nothing in it. Hmm. So just as a matter of normal due diligence, my paralegal emailed the state's paralegal and said, are we missing something? Is there supposed to be something in the file? And we got back an email that said the file was correctly empty, which was just a weird turn of phrase. And so we went to the expert's deposition. laid the groundwork that the expert had been communicating by email with all of his colleagues. And then I asked him, why don't we have any emails? And to my surprise, he said quite plainly that the expert team had agreed at their first meeting that they would delete all of their emails, and that an attorney from the Washington AG's office was present during that conversation.
And the attorney general at the time, Bob Ferguson?
Well, he wasn't there, obviously.
Right.
But
he was in charge of the
office. He was in charge of the office.
What happens in a conference room when something like that is uttered?
Inside, I was shocked because I didn't expect that to be the answer. I expected the answer to be like, oh, they're coming, they were misplaced or something. And so it was frankly shocking. And the whole room, I think, felt it. When the answer came out so plainly that, nope, we just deleted everything with no remorse, with no sense that it was wrong. From an attorney's perspective at that point, you know, you have your game face on, right? You're not showing the shock. You just need to have your face that says, tell me more. Talk to me some more about that. Because we didn't really know what the response would be from the other side, whether the state's attorneys knew this, didn't know this? Was this a surprise to them? They certainly didn't seem surprised by it in the deposition.
We reached out to Attorney General Ferguson's office, which sent us a statement. It begins, quote, "This was one very experienced attorney who made an egregious error." Ferguson goes on to say in the statement that it never should have happened and that his office took immediate action and has taken steps to make sure it doesn't happen again. They hired computer forensic experts to dig out what they could from the missing emails. They conducted an internal audit of how attorneys and paralegals handle evidence and the discovery process, and the AG's office sent all staff to outside training on handling electronic records such as emails. The judge fined the state a total of $1.2 million for the deleted emails, and the case itself never went to trial because the defendants chose to settle. The state and the timberland owners paid the families a total of $60 million. But the legal questions are not all answered. There's a petition in front of the state Supreme Court to consider whether Snohomish County can be sued for failing to warn of the landslide dangers after a lower court ruled the county was immune from the claims. Harris, the attorney for the families, says not going to trial was a double-edged sword. On one hand, they didn't have to sit in court and relive the details of the landslide for days on end. On the other hand, there was never a public airing of their case.
I think the trial would have shown, I think the evidence of trial would have shown that the man-made alterations to the land that people knew about and the dangers that the state knew about and the county knew about but that they didn't talk about to people, the evidence would have shown that was part of the contributing factor for the magnitude of what had happened. And so that full story, I don't think, has been really told.
This was a disaster caused by humans, in some part at least, mismanaging nature. And it can be pretty extreme here in Washington State, nature. And so I wonder if there are other danger areas, other problem spots that people should be made aware of, that you became aware of as you started looking into what was going on in Oso.
Well, I think there are. And I think what you say is true. I mean, this nature started this process of the Oso landslide, but what people did to the slide area to protect salmon, frankly, out of, you know, good intentions, but not really understanding the full scope of what they did, led to greater harm. A big issue in the case was what impact the crib wall that had been built at the base of the landslide, what impact that had on the magnitude of this slide.
The crib wall was made of wood, 15 feet high and the length of 5 football fields. It was put in place after an earlier, smaller slide.
And we learned from some of the expert emails that were recovered that the presence of that loose landslide material held back by this crib wall so that it didn't erode over time as it normally would have was the killing force of the landslide. Are there other areas in Washington State that people should be concerned about? I'm sure there are. And in my experience since the case, more and more people are just aware that they need to ask those questions for themselves and not rely on the government.
Are we any further down that road? Is that information available now?
I think in some places it is. I don't think that there is a lot of, in the geologic hazard mapping, that there is not a lot of showing where the runouts are. So there might be an indication of where a prior landslide happened. But in the looking at where could this landslide go, or am I in an area where there is a potential for debris flow, that information is not, as far as I know, as widely available as it should be. And certainly at the time was not.
The state told me on the phone yesterday that they had, before the landslide, basically one half of a geotechnical engineer working on landslides. He was one person full time, but half of his time was tsunamis and other hazards, and then half of his time was landslides. And now they have six people just working on landslides full time, which seems like your face suggests not enough.
Not enough. I mean, I know we have lots of challenges in our state, and we have to address many things, but the natural hazards in our state that are worsened by human activity here, I think, deserve our attention, especially after the tragedy that happened.
Emily Harris is managing partner of Core Cronin. The Seattle law firm was one of four representing families who sued after the landslide. And we double-checked with the state after we taped that interview. It turns out there are seven geotechnical engineers working on landslides now. So let's talk a little about what's been done and whether it's enough. We dropped by the Olympia office of Hillary France. She is Washington State's Commissioner of Public Lands. Among the things she oversees is the state's geological survey. France was elected in 2016 after the landslide and after the state had already started changing some of its systems in response to what happened in OSO.
So in coming into this position, was aware of work we had already started ramping up about being able to map all of our landslides within Washington State. To date, we have already completed mapping of over half of the state as to the area of landslide potential, and that half of that state translates into 51% of our population is now very aware, if they go online to our mapping and our data, to the location and proximity of that landslide and what type of landslide it is. We've been providing that information to local government. Local government sets the laws around what can happen, what buildings can be built in a landslide area, because the first step is getting our communities and our public that education and information about resources.
Now, as we mentioned earlier, the state expanded its geology team, and DNR is doing more LIDAR mapping. That is a 3D technique that offers a more detailed view of the landscape around Washington. But a huge component of this is public information, making sure that people are aware of the hazards. And that can be a challenge, especially with the passage of time. Franz told me about a conversation she had with a state geologist. He pointed out some homes that were developed in a potential landslide zone, and she asked him, when was the last time that area had a landslide?
And he said, well, 500 to 1,000 years ago, right? So the hard part of that is, you know, once a slide doesn't mean there won't ever be another slide, but it's hard for us in our memories right now today to think about, well, 500 to 1,000 years ago, how much of a chance does it have to actually slide again?
Well, and I wonder, I mean, just personally, I wonder, does a long time horizon like that mean, okay, we're good to go, or does it mean we're due?
And that is exactly the right question. I mean, it's the same context of earthquake, right? And I look at our own Washington State, and especially the mapping that we've done on the where that quake will happen, where those fault lines are. And I think we might have very much a sense of false sense of security here, that no matter how much we try to raise the context of watch out for earthquakes, watch out for landslides, people forget what's happened before, and they're like, well, maybe not in my lifetime.
The Department of Natural Resources is asking state lawmakers for more money this session, including $1.4 million for the next 2 years to add more geologists to the state payroll, plus another $820,000 for two road engineers. Franz says building roads through forested areas can sometimes destabilize landscapes. She wants the state to keep gathering information and then put that information to use. Franz says her agency has already put into practice the recommendations made by the State Route 530 Landslide Commission. Their report from December of 2014 is available through a link on our website, knkx.org. This is a special presentation of KNKX News. I'm Ed Ronco. Tonight, we're looking back on the Oso landslide 5 years later. On Friday, the community gathered at the site of the landslide for a ceremony of remembrance. Dane Bruner helped lead it. His sister, Summer Raffo, was killed as she drove down State Route 530. Bruner has also been involved in planning a memorial.
You know, we have trees here. We have, you know, our own little monuments and our own little keepsakes at home. But the world doesn't know. They come here and they see this, and it doesn't. There's nothing that says, "Hey, what happened here? Who died? Why? What? Who were these people and stuff?" My sister was the only one on the road that died. She didn't live here, and I want her story to be told. And see that as her older brother, that gives me satisfaction to know that her legacy is going to live on through this memorial.
Over the past 5 years, the Snohomish County Parks Department has been working with many of the victims' families to design and create that memorial. It would sit on 2 to 4 acres, land where no one lived and where no one was found after the event. Tom Tigan is the director of the County Parks Department. KNKX producer Jeffrey Reddick met him at the department's headquarters.
Let's talk a little bit about how that relationship between your department and the families who have been involved has evolved over the years.
Yeah, it's been a tough process, honestly. A lot of really wonderful people, a lot of great friends now, folks that I consider brothers and sisters. But they went through something very horrendous. But they're so solid and they're so resilient and you know, very caring. It gives you a really good reason and purpose for, you know, bringing the best you can to the equation, understanding how important it is to honor their lives, the lives of their loved ones lost, the commitment they made in being out there searching for loved ones, the commitment they've made in trying to create a memorial, you know, their ability to be gracious and resilient and tough and angry and loving all at the same time. That's pretty astounding.
Can you take me through what you think the memorial will look like? So what do we see, and what does the memorial invite us to do while we're there?
So as you come up to the site, you're probably traveling from the west on the Oso Slide Memorial Highway. And as you arrive to the site, you need this physical amount of time as you walk through the site to kind of decompress. You take a breath and you kind of emotionally, physically, spiritually, you kind of decompress, and then there's reception, and that's what you'll see, kind of the entry into the plaza, and you move your way through the orientation of the site, which is kind of the mapping of it and everything, to the interpretation, which that then gets into then all these, the first responders, what happened at the site geologically, and you'll be able to also then go through a series of memorials to the individual victims or families of victims. And then I think our hope is that final transition or transformation moment is when you leave, you're going to leave understanding the gravity of what happened, but hopefully hopeful and surprised and value the resilience.
And so 15 or 20 years from now, if somebody who arrives at the site and has never been to the Pacific Northwest, doesn't know anything about this beyond when they stop, how do you hope the site conveys the meaning of its space?
That's been the key in laying it out, so that we really want to make sure we're telling the story of these lives lost, of these people, that, and it was real people living in a real neighborhood in a really beautiful place, and this happened. And I think if you ask most of the families, what they want to know is that their sister or their brother or husband or wife or grandkids is going to be remembered for multiple generations for their smile or who they were. So that's what they'll see there.
You mentioned it was a beautiful space. And as it stands now, the, you know, what you can see in evidence of the slide, there's still such a huge scar, and the site itself is vast. It strikes me that this memorial has the chance to kind of return the beauty to that particular space.
Yeah, and I think when you come into the site, one of the first big places is going to be the community gathering remembrance space. And one of the things we've talked about is in that community gathering place is having kind of this pole with the tree of life, and it would have the 43 branches or leaves that represent our 43 victims. And then across the plaza, across this community gathering space, there's probably a big boulder that's been etched, you know, with all the names of folks who were lost. And then the designer, it was great, said, and so on March 22nd at 10:37, if the sun is shining, then it'll go through these 43 leaves, and the shadow will go across the plaza and be on that stone. So the families were like, that's amazing, it's awesome. But then one of the family members is like, it's never going to be sunny on March 20. He just laid into it. And everyone started laughing. And the fact is, you know, it just is one instance of hundreds, if not thousands, I've had of these families being both absolutely practical, but also kind of saying, this is great, this is nice hoity-toity, but that beautiful plan with your, it's probably not going to work because it's freaking raining every March twice. So when we're sitting here talking about it, it's important thinking about how all those interactions have played out. It's pretty stunning.
Is there a timeline for starting to build?
Yeah, we've really started the fundraising this year. We on the four-year commemoration, many of the families were to the point where they wanted to now start down this path and be more purposeful about it. So a number of our local firms have agreed to be involved with doing the geotechnical work and doing design and engineering work and doing stuff pro bono. So it's pretty stunning what happened. The roadway now and where Steelhead Drive is actually 18 feet above the previous road grade. Mm-hmm. It's a complicated site for us to actually do a memorial too, because then we have all those same geotechnical considerations and we are on the edge of a floodplain. So the other big thing was deciding, and we had this in these early guiding draft principles, are we creating a foundation to manage it? Is it going to be managed as the park site? If it is, how do we endow that? How do we make sure that 100 years from now, you know, it's going to be taken care of? We have now two different executives that have been county executives at this time, multiple new council members, and the fact is this is one thing that everybody supports. They understand that this is something that outlives any of us.
Tom Tigan. He's director of the Snohomish County Department of Parks, Recreation, and Tourism. He spoke with Jeffrey Reddick. There's more information on the plans and the fund for a permanent memorial at slidememorial.com. We're going to wrap up our stories from Oso tonight by listening to a conversation with Tim Ward. He and his wife, Brandy, moved to the Steelhead Haven neighborhood in 2007. Tim and Brandy were both home when the landslide happened. He was badly injured, and she did not survive. Tim Ward talked to us from the studios of WUFT in Gainesville, Florida, near his new home. He told me about what happened that day, the enormous loss, but also how the 5 years since then have brought him new purpose and new love.
I remember the morning. It was quite comfortable. It was one of the first sunny days we'd had in months. We had had an extremely wet winter. My wife and I were sitting in the living room. We had a group of five German shorthair pointers that got pampered quite readily, and on that weekend, she was getting ready to fix them a big fry pan full of scrambled eggs, and I was going to go get a shower, and I heard what I thought was going to be the Navy jets that flew by up the valley every other weekend. We could hear them come up there, and they'd be doing their training runs, and something happened, and that rumbling did not go away. It continued to get louder and louder, and I realized suddenly we must be having an earthquake. And I could hear my wife calling out my name, and what was happening was the mudslide had started. It had hit the river, which was just at the base of the mountain, and it was like hitting a sheet of Teflon, and it accelerated. Mm. What was happening with my wife was she saw what was coming through because there was a series of large plate glass windows, and so she was trying to give me warning. I knew one of two things was happening. Either one, it was the worst dream I had ever had in my life, and at which I'd wake up and I'd be fine. But if it wasn't a dream, I knew that I was about to face some challenges, and I started praying. And one of the last things I remember was hearing her voice, feeling the mud coming up over my nose, and my prayers going out to the Lord Jesus Christ that I don't have time to die right now. I have too much to do for you. And that's honestly the last comment that I can remember until I woke up. And I don't know how long it was before I woke up, but I woke up about 500 yards downhill from my house, about 15 feet below the surface.
I heard that you could see a little sky above you.
I could. I could actually see the blue sky. I saw the top of some fir trees. I could see them blowing, and I realized that I must be in some trouble because my body was facing one way and my legs were facing another.
So how did you get out?
I started calling out for my wife, and I did not get a response from her, but I did get a response from another gentleman, one of my neighbor's fathers. He was also buried. He was close enough we could hear each other, but that's all I could understand. So I started trying to whistle. I started trying to call out. And eventually, one of my neighbors that I didn't even know, he was from Seapost Road, he heard me. About the time he got to where my mound was, where he was going to start digging me out, I saw a helicopter fly by. I could see it through the opening in the hole. I called out to the neighbor, and he says, "I see it too. I'll wave him down." And he waved down a Black Hawk helicopter.
I understand that you have kept in touch with many of the other folks who were affected, and you would talk about doing good works in the community and doing other things for the community?
There were 52 people home that morning, either as residents or as people working on property out there as contractors or vendors. And of those 52 people, there were only 9 of us that were dug out. So for the other 43 people, there were thousands of people that were touched, either in pain or in remorse or in confusion, in loss. But at the same time, they were giving to us in such a way that you really couldn't describe. The comfort was warming, and it was deep. It was passionate. And we have learned over the years how to reach out and do things that to the average person would seem so simple. To provide a Thanksgiving meal to the homeless, or to provide a sanitary kit to hand out to someone who doesn't have what you would think of as the normal daily life things, like toilet paper and baby wipes and some snacks for during the day when they're trying to make it. And we realized that, you know, just like we were buried in mud and we needed help, that some of the other community members did as well. And so we started reaching out and trying to find what it was we could do.
It seems like what you've just described might even be part of the healing process.
Oh, most definitely, because we've learned how to give from the place we stood at. It gave us the ability to reach out and hold someone and to comfort them and to let them know that they really, truly were loved.
When did you move to Florida?
Moved to Florida in 2016. Back in February or March of that year, I got on the road. I had no idea where I was going to go other than the fact that my brother lived down in Homestead, southwest side of Miami. I took my service dog, Blue, with me, who was the only surviving dog of that pack of 5 that I had. And I looked on the map and I said, well, I've got a relative here and I've got a friend there. And I got down to Miami and my brother had mentioned to me that he said, hey, I've got a friend that's got a boat down in the Keys. Would you like to go fishing? There was going to be a dinner at the house. We were going to have a little barbecue. And I called up a young lady. Her name was Clara Werner. And I said, hey, Clara, this is Tim. We'd been on Facebook for years. Her and my wife and I, we all actually grew up in high school together in junior high. I said, would you like to come over for dinner? She says, well, sure, where are you at? And I give her an address, and she says, I'll be there in 10 minutes. And I'll fast forward, but about a year later, I proposed to her. I proposed to her on the Space Needle in Seattle after she had come out and met my children, after I had been out and met her family. And we got married on April 8th, 2017, and it's been a time of total joy and recovery. And as a matter of fact, she's sitting here with me smiling as we talk, and I can't be more happy with the way the Lord has changed my life. And now, don't take me wrong. I would go back to my old life in a heartbeat if that was what the Lord God had planned for me. But for some reason, He chose differently. And so at this point in my life, I'm happily going down the path that He's given me with my service dog, Blue. He was the last dog that was found. And poor little Blue had been trying to get out of there for 3 days. He had degloved his own foot, and then he had dislocated his right hip. He's an extremely agile and strong 12-year-old tripod German short-hair pointer now. And 90% of the time, everywhere I go, he's right there with me.
How does he like Florida?
He thinks he's in heaven. A bird dog that sits on the front porch of a 10-acre piece of land that are covered in deer and turkey and you name it, all the creatures of the southeast. And he just sits there with his little paws crossed, sitting on the front porch, looking off, smiling.
I know Blue isn't going to speak English to you, but it seems like you and Blue both went through this together, and you're now in a place surrounded by people who didn't go through this. Does having Blue nearby, you know, help you, I don't know, have somebody there who understands?
He's always part of the life. He's always part of the story. Blue actually has a very intimate relationship with my family. And it started, believe it or not, on the day he was born, because Blue is called Blue because he was born stillbirth. He was the last dog of the last litter from Samson and Delilah, which were my stud and dam. And when he was born, my first wife, Brandy, was a nurse, and she said, I'm not going to lose a puppy. And she gave Blue mouth to snout and chest compressions and brought him back. He's alive because my first wife's breath was in his body. So the emotional tie to him, there's no words for it.
We were in Oso last night and talked to some folks. They mentioned the community as tight-knit, and they said it's become more so in the 5 years since. And I wonder if that holds true, even if you're somewhere else as you are.
Oh, definitely. It was one of those communities to where you could knock on the door and ask your neighbor, hey, do you have some children's Tylenol? My child is sick, and it's a long drive into town. And everybody was always there to help each other out. I mean, when I first moved there, John Riggelbrugge, who was the Navy commander, would come over to my property, and we'd both grab big weed whackers, and we'd just sit there and work on the blackberries because we knew they were good to be out there, but they could take over 5 acres in a heartbeat.
Sometimes the simple things become the things we remember, right? I mean, you just described, you know, essentially doing yard work, and it's things like that that are like really special to people. That when you look back on your time in a place, those are the things that seem to stick with you, you know?
Exactly. And we had one of our neighbors. His name was Scott, and his wife was Debbie. Their last name was Rule. They had moved away before the slide, but Scott had passed away just shortly before the slide from cancer. But one of the best memories I have of Scott was he would come over to the edge of his white picket fence, and it would be right next to my garden. He'd point down at the bush, and he'd go, I think I see a strawberry. I think it's ready. And we'd go down there, and we'd pick up a handful of strawberries and hand it to him. And we'd sit there while we were harvesting the strawberries and talking and just sharing fellowship. We were building a bond, and it was one of those bonds that doesn't go away. We'll never forget the best times that we had, the sitting on the back porch, the cutting of the grass, the weeding of the yard, just sitting out by a fire, talking and telling stories to each other.
It's been 5 years. Does any of it feel different?
The month of March will always be a hard month. The month of October will be hard for me because that was the month of my wedding with Brandy back in 1977. November 1st was her birthday. So those type things will always touch a soft spot. And a lot of people say, well, it's been 5 years. Why are you still harping over it? It's not that people harp over it, and it's not that people focus on it because they want to. You can't erase the life that was there before. There's times when you reach for something, and all of a sudden you realize, oh, I don't have that anymore. That's in a pile of dirt somewhere in Washington State. And I catch myself all the time. I'll be out working on a project, and I'll reach for a tool, and I'll know I have that tool. I know that specialty tool is on the third drawer of my red Craftsman toolbox until I look at that Craftsman toolbox and realize that that's only 3 years old toolbox, and what I'm thinking of is from a past. So now, 5 years later, I don't cry as much as I used to because I think I've come to more of a state of comfort because of where God has me on my day-to-day. But I don't think it will ever go away, and I don't want it to go away. You need pain of certain types to keep your edge sharp so that you can help other people get out of the debris field that they're going to be found in, no matter what it is in life. And if that's what it takes for me to stay focused, then I cherish it, and I want it to stay with me.
Tim Ward. He survived the Ozo landslide on March 22, 2014, and now lives in Florida. Our longer conversation is on our website, knkx.org. Jeffrey Reddick produced this program. Our news director is Aaron Hennessy. Kari Plogue is our digital content manager, and Matt Martinez is our director of content. We want to say thank you to everyone we talked to in Oso for being so gracious and so generous with the stories they shared. This has been a special presentation of KNKX News. I'm Ed Ronco.